When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 2014, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi closed the Planning Commission, which he accused of stifling the country's growth and being a holdover from its time as a socialist country. It was an ignoble end to the government body, which in the early days of independence wrote the country's five-year plans for economic development. Nikhil Menon, in his first book, Planning Democracy, Modern India's Quest for Development, from Cambridge University Press, looks at how India's efforts towards economic planning helped the country find a path between Western and Soviet economic models, supercharge the growth of Indian statistics, and try to foster a more public democracy. Nikhil Menon is a historian of modern South Asia specializing in the political and economic history of 20th century India. His research explores the histories of democracy and development in independent India. Today, Nikhil and I talk about Planning and Democracy, Statistics, and perhaps one of the book's central figures, Professor Mahala Nobis, the father of Indian statistics. So, Nikhil, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Planning Democracy. You know, maybe let's start with the actual just subject of your book. Why did you want to make India's economic planning the topic of the history you wanted to write?
Firstly, thank you, Nicholas, for having me on. It's a real pleasure. So the book that I wrote, Planning Democracy, is based on research that I did for my PhD. And while I applied for the PhD, I was actually proposing to work on a very different subject. But I think just being in a new intellectual environment, I moved continents for my PhD. And this being this new intellectual environment, I think just led me to looking to new pastures. And I increasingly came to be drawn to the idea of studying how independent India made its way after centuries of foreign rule. The history of independent India is something that, while it is very important, obviously, is not, or at least was not till I was in college, a subject that you can study in history courses. Our histories tended to end with August 15th, 1947, when India got independence from British colonial rule. So that's the terrain that I want to look into. And planning was a subject that I'd read about in newspapers growing up or on news shows. But I felt that we didn't have or know enough about why India decided to take up the five-year plans in the first place. Growing up in the 1990s, planning was very unfashionable as India marketized and liberalized its economy. But yet, surprising as it may be, I found that there was a time when planning was actually fashionable. And I want to uncover how planning became quite so mainstream in public policy, so desirable to a range of political parties, and so central, really, to the story of modern independent India. And what appealed to me was not the question, really, of whether these five-year plans succeeded or failed, but why India adopted them in the first place. And while when I first entered the archives, like most scholars or researchers, I didn't have a very clear idea of what the book's sort of architecture would look like. And in some sense, I just allowed myself to be led by the archive. And that's what led me to the themes of the book, which are on the history of India's statistical infrastructure, India's first computers, and the role played by popular culture, Bollywood, and even Hindu ascetics in promoting the five-year plans.
Right. And I have questions on a lot of those topics, but I want to, my next question, you know, if your book has a main character, it's Professor Mahalanobis, who's, I think, kind of often seen as the father of Indian statistics. He kind of grows this whole division, this whole discipline, out of seemingly nothing. And I do say character, he seems to be flying all over the world, going to parties, meeting a lot of other interesting academics.
Well, more meetings and parties.
Well, meetings and parties, yes, yes. Salons, maybe, is the better, more. But he's meeting all these important people, important economists. But who exactly was he, and how important is he to this history you're trying to explain?
Yeah, I think that Mahalanobis is really a figure that we ought to know much more about. He was quite simply one of the most influential Indians of his generation. You know, someone born in the late 19th century, he grows up this culturally refined physicist, educated at Presidency College in Calcutta and then King's College at Cambridge. He was, by all accounts, brilliant, charismatic, but also a very, very serious figure, someone who was sort of polymathic, you know, a physicist, as I said, somebody who becomes a sort of self-taught statistician, but also versed in ancient Indian Sanskrit texts, somebody who possesses a discerning ear for Bengali poetry, dabbles in architecture as well. But also he's someone who's really animated by a sense of purpose, who wants his academic work to matter for nation building. And his interest in statistics begins quite by accident. And for a few decades, he really wears two hats as a lecturer of physics back at Presidency College in Calcutta, but also as a sort of almost side hustle, India's leading statistician on the side. And he becomes quickly becomes a global pioneer in the use of large-scale sample surveys, which is a new kind of experimental statistics, which he pioneers in India, and which he conducts through the Indian Statistical Institute, an institute which exists still today, is one of India's leading research organizations in the social sciences, and which he founds in the early 1930s. And by the time India wins independence, Mahalanobis is already a celebrated scientist, more so for his statistical work than his work as a physicist. And he is increasingly coming to be associated with this social scientific practice that is used now across the world. And for example, in 1945, he's elected to the Royal Society. And what I trace over the book is the next two decades of independent India, when Mahalanobis, or the professor, as I refer to him, because many of his contemporaries refer to him just as the professor, Mahalanobis would design India's National Sample Survey, which India uses till this day. He would be instrumental in bringing India's first two digital computers. He would be critical in establishing India's data infrastructure, its statistical infrastructure. He would author also, perhaps most importantly, the second five-year plan, which broadly lays out the template for India's economic policy from the 1950s till the 1990s. So a really, really important figure. And a common view about why Mahalanobis comes to play this really important role in India's economic history is because of his proximity to India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. And in my book, I try to argue against this and say that this is a really unsatisfactory explanation, and it's one that's kind of too personality-centric. Because Mahalanobis and Nehru weren't family members, nor were they close friends from their youth. And there were many other economists in the country. And so I think the reason for Mahalanobis's position in Indian economic history is more structural. And that structural reason is that centralized planning, which India committed to after independence, required huge masses of data about the economy. And that is the kind of data that India lacked. And then, just as now, there existed this somewhat utopian view that if you had adequate data, that then the solution to India's economic problems would be apparent. And Mahalanobis and the Indian Statistical Institute offered ways by which planners could gather this data as pioneers in data infrastructure at this point in Indian history. And so through the National Sample Survey, which he helped set up, through the Central Statistical Organization, which he is at the helm of, it's through these things that Mahalanobis comes to be associated with planning. And we can't just assign that to, random friendship.
In reading your book, I mean, it shows it takes time for statistics to kind of take this role in India's planning. You know, one of the stories I'm remembering from the beginning of your book is where they put the statisticians against the enumerators as a way to prove who was actually the most accurate in counting yields. And it turned out that statistics were more accurate than actually sending people to count the yields, I guess, in person and by hand. But I think throughout the book, there's tensions with other departments. There's tensions. There's fights over resources. How easy or how difficult was it for statistics to kind of really get this role in India's planning?
Yeah, I think that the early 20th century in India is also maps onto the rise of statistics as a scientific discipline globally as well. And so at the turn of the century, we confront a situation where Mahal Nobis is from the, after the First World War, is increasingly interested in statistics, in especially the emerging science of sampling. But he finds that in India, statistics isn't taken seriously. He finds that, for example, at the Indian Science Congress, statistics would not be given a separate section because it was just not considered a science. One scientist, in fact, snidely remarks that if you were to give statistics a section, you might as well give astrology another. And so this is a bitter complaint of Mahal Nobis. And what happens effectively from the 1920s to the 1940s is, from being in a situation where statistics would be denied its own section at the Indian Science Congress, by 1946 or 47, Mahal Nobis is the chairperson of the Indian Science Congress as a statistician, right? So it really gives you a sense of the quite meteoric rise in the status of this science amongst other sciences. And part of the ways in which Mahal Nobis proves the worth of sampling is by these kinds of these tests that he's able to sail through with flying colors, in which, as you suggested, when the colonial government of Bengal was trying to estimate jute yields, they tried to test this new method that Mahal Nobis was promoting, that of large-scale sample surveys, against that of plot-to-plot enumeration. And what they found is that not only was the errors with the plot-to-plot enumeration was about 16%, whereas it was much, much lower with the sample surveys, also it was a fraction of the cost to do a sample survey, right? So it really sort of offers proof of concept in tests such as these. But what you also see during this period is that while sample surveying is coming to be seen as a legitimate science in the early 20th century, it still isn't used at a national level in India, partly because of the nature of colonial statistics, which from the late 19th century onwards was disaggregated, done by separate provinces, and was focused on administration and trade alone. And so national statistics and the effort to build a national statistical infrastructure would really be a post-colonial phenomenon, something that would begin in the 1950s. And the Indian statistical infrastructure, I argue in the book, rises not just organically because the science itself is proving itself, but in response to the demands of centralized planning. It is because India commits itself to a centralized five-year plan-based system for the economy that India's leaders are now suddenly looking around for institutions and individuals that can spearhead this effort to gather data at a level that the state had not required during the colonial period. And it's because of this sort of sterling reputation of Mahal Nobis and the emerging science of statistics and large-scale sample surveys and the Indian Statistical Institute that they then come to be seen as the prime candidates for this transformation and for the erection of this new data infrastructure that would come to be associated with the Central Statistical Organization, the National Sample Survey, and other organizations that worked for it. And the National Sample Survey really was a quite extraordinary venture. It was viewed by contemporary scientists and statisticians across the world with admiration, even awe. The sheer scale seemed foolhardy to many, even to statisticians who were, sympathetic to Mahal Nobis. And in the book, I talk about some of the challenges that the National Sample Survey surveyors had to deal with. They were contending with dealing with dozens of languages, different units of measurements, having to pass snow-filled mountains, thick forests with man-eating tigers, dealing with Adivasis or tribal populations that didn't understand the enterprise and why there were these National Sample Survey investigators across the country asking them about their, you know, what kinds of assets they had. But this survey, which began in 1951, continues till today, and it is the most important measure by which, way by which, method by which India and the Indian state knows about the economic life of its citizens. And as you know, as the Nobel Prize winning economist Angus Deaton has said, that you know, where Mahalanobis led, the rest of the world followed in terms of instituting sample surveys of household income and expenditure in mainstream economic practice across the world. And today we've got to the point today where the new UN Statistical Commission exists. There's a UN subcommission on sample surveys, and the World Bank and the UN both conduct these kinds of large-scale sample surveys in more than 100 countries across the world.
So I want to get back to talk about economic planning and kind of also kind of how geopolitics, the Cold War, plays into this. You know, India and Mahalanobis, tries to chart kind of a non-aligned path between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. How was that reflected in its economic planning or in its attempts to kind of develop these economic plans?
Yes, it's a well-known fact that India, after independence under Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, is one of the leaders in the non-aligned movement during the Cold War. It's a stance which is based on the principle that as recently decolonized countries, we do not want to once again be ensnared by sort of global power politics. We do not want to become a satellite to either the United States or the Soviet Union. And so we will chart our own path and not sort of ally ourselves with either of these global superpowers that are in competition. And so my book explores how India tries to, in some ways, how India's planning project is the domestic reflection of that foreign policy vision. And it explores how India tries to combine both Soviet-inspired socialist five-year plans with Western liberal democracy during the Cold War, which of course pits these as institutionally and ideologically incompatible. And this is reflected in the nature of Indian planning, which is subjected, as Western liberal democracies are, subjected to democratic popular pressure through the mechanism of elections every 5 years, which allow Indian citizens to vote against, you know, the government's economic policies. But on the other hand, planning is also in some ways walled off from popular pressure, like in socialist countries, through the institution of the Planning Commission. So the Planning Commission is a technocratic body of unelected individuals that is meant to adjudicate on these economic decisions at a remove from public pressure or from interest groups. And so my book tries to walk the line of exploring this fissure or this fracture that lies or runs through the Indian planning project, this dichotomy between its technocratic and its democratic avatars. And what it argues is that India was trying to put these two together in what I call an arranged marriage, and one that was never quite resolved, but was always in tension with each other. I think that this extends not just to the nature of Indian planning, but to the nature of Indian statistics as well. Because, as I said, the kind of sample surveys that India had, that Mahalanobis pioneered, and through the Indian Statistical Institute and the National Sample Survey, became institutionalized in the Indian state. This was associated more with Western liberal democracies. These are the kinds of projects that the United Kingdom and the United States were embarking on, though even they were learning from India at the time in terms of how to lay them out at as vast a scale as India was attempting to do it. But on the other hand, in communist countries, in the Soviet Union and China, sample surveying was actually seen as a bourgeois and capitalist method and was rejected both by the Soviet Union and under Mao in China in the 1950s. And so, once again, you see that India is trying to both combine a five-year planning project, which is associated with the Soviet Union and China, but combining methods within the five-year plans that are associated with economies that don't have socialistic five-year plans, right? And so, in fact, on the ways in which China developed its economic systems and deemed sample serving to be anathema to it ideologically, I mean, I'd like to sort of flag the work of Arnab Ghosh, who's sort of written an excellent book on this.
It's funny you mentioned the Soviet Union and China. One of the funny nuggets I pulled out from your book was the idea that the idea of sample surveys was seen as anti-Marxist, because of course Marxism is all determinism. You know, it's all but probabilities don't play into it, which I thought was very funny.
right. Yeah. There is no room for probability in a deterministic system. Yeah.
But I want to maybe drill down a bit more into this connection you try to draw between the economic planning and the development of kind of India's democracy, and it's kind of what the second half of your book deals with, which is kind of trying to. Ways to get the Indian populace to really get on board with these plans, to encourage them to support the plans through and to really kind of understand, I guess, their goals through things like movies and films and posters and other various methods. Could you talk a bit more about, again, this kind of attempt to kind of connect the planning and the democracy sides of India?
Absolutely. As I suggested earlier, my book is trying to explore this tension between planning in its technocratic realms and planning in its democratic avatar. And the first half of my book really looks at this top-down elite aspect of planning, of setting up statistical systems, of bringing India's first computers. And in this part, Because of the way in which technocracy operates, ordinary Indians are quite nameless and faceless objects of the technocracy. But the second half of the book delves into the idea of democratic planning, as you suggest, this notion that planning was also a political project of participatory democracy. And this is what distinguishes, in the eyes of the Indian state and of the Nehruvian government, it's what distinguishes Indian planning from planning in authoritarian contexts like that of China and the Soviet Union. And that India's brand of planning, India's brand of non-alignment in foreign policy and democratic planning at home is what India was offering as a beacon to the decolonizing third world. So this is the sort of grand vision of the government in its own eyes. And democratic planning was this idea that Indian planning was fundamentally different from communist planning. And I think that the reason the government focused on it and kept sort of talking about it in sort of endless rhetoric in the 1950s and 60s is because, one, I think that there was a genuine idealism, critics might say naivete, about the way in which democracy and popular participation are necessary to make the plans truly democratic, to make the state truly democratic, to make this newly decolonized nation one that is a participatory democracy, and that democracy came into real fruition only when citizens were aware of what the state was doing and participated in them enthusiastically. But apart from this idealism, I also think that there is a realism that is barely under the surface, and that realism is that the Indian state is too weak compared to the Chinese state or the Soviet state to make these plans work, and that the Indian state capacity is so poor that these plans only have a shot at succeeding if you are able to generate mass enthusiasm about these planned projects. And in fact, not just have people saving in accordance to the way in which the government wants in, you know, bonds or in particular government schemes. You want them spending in accordance to the way in which the government wants. You want them to be agreeable to the idea of delaying consumer satisfaction such that India can build up an industrial capacity. But you also want just voluntary participation such that you have unremunerated contributions towards the plan. And that there's a realism about understanding that Indian plans, however technocratic, however technical, just do not have a shot in the real world unless there are these voluntary contributions. And so the government goes to extraordinary lengths to publicize the plans. For example, I talk about these publicity officers that work, that travel every few days on bullock carts, on jeeps, on boats, on carts, carrying publicity materials, film projectors. There's a whole separate song and drama division of dramatic troupes that are employed by the government of India to, and are given, you know, paper scripts of plays which blend with the goals of the 5-year plan, and then perform these plays and ballads across the country. There were something called university planning forums by which the Planning Commission sought to reach out to the sort of the young intelligentsia, students at colleges and universities. There was an entirely voluntary organization called the Bharat Sevak Samaj, or the Indian Society, sort of Indian Voluntary Society. And perhaps most intriguingly, and something that perhaps we can talk about later, the Bharat Sadhu Samaj, or the Indian Society of Ascetics. I look at a range of documentary films produced by the Films Division of India, which are really fascinating, one of which is about a village being visited by an alien every 5 years. And while the villager complains to us, the viewer, about how the 5-year plans have done nothing for him, through the eyes of the alien, you can see how India is transformed. And while the government's efforts at this were a mixed bag, and there were some successes, but many failures as well, I think that another gauge to assess the extent to which planning seeped into the popular culture is by looking at what mass popular culture was at the time, and to see if there was any effect of this publicity campaign by the government. And as I show in the book, there was. I mean, there we have novels such as the very highly regarded Jhoota Sach, which came out in two parts in 1958 and 1960. We have plays like Hamara Gaon, all of which reflect planned themes. We have Bollywood movies like Naya Daur with big film stars like Dilip Kumar, Chaar Dil Chaar Rahe with other huge superstars like Raj Kapoor, Shami Kapoor, Meena Kumari. There are Bollywood songs sung by, singers who are recognizable to almost any sort of Hindi speaker in North India today, like Lata Mangeshkar, Mohammed Rafi, Asha Bhosle, whose chorus is literally about the 5-year plan, the Panch Varshiya Yojana. And so I think that by looking at a combination of the government's own publicity or propaganda, and at the way in which it's reflected in popular culture, we get a sense of a public culture that is suffused with the language of the 5-year plans, of planning.
I want to ask about one particular example of this that you mentioned in your answer, which is the work with the sadhus, the holy men, to advertise the plant, which I think even people at the time maybe. Putting the spin on it, which was kind of the nominally secular Congress Party adopting Hindu symbols and working with these holy men to sell these plans to its population. Kind of how did religion end up kind of playing a role in at least the advertising of these policy plans?
This was actually perhaps the most surprising thing I found in the archive. Which is that the government of Jawaharlal Nehru, which is seen in India as a kind of secular or technocratic high water mark, comparatively to other governments at least, was actually involved with Hindu ascetics or holy men in a campaign to spread the message of the 5-year plans. And, given that this book is about planning, I really did not expect to be writing about holy men or ascetics. But what happens, what I discovered, is that in early 1956, an organization called the Bharat Sadhu Samaj, or the Indian Society of Ascetics, is established after a meeting between Congress politicians and these sadhus or Hindu ascetics at a Hindu temple, Birla Mandir, in Delhi. And despite the Prime Minister's, that is Nehru's, quite deep ambivalence about the venture, it was enthusiastically promoted by much more God-fearing national figures like the President of India at the time, Rajendra Prasad, and the Minister for Planning, Gulzarilal Nanda. And the Samaj was, or the Bharat Sadhu Samaj was instituted on the belief, which was shared by both these Congress members and Hindu ascetics, that these holy men would help popularize the 5-year plans amongst the country's very devout millions or hundreds of millions, right? That the technocratic language and discourse of planning that emanated from Yojana Bhavan or, the the headquarters of the Planning Commission in Delhi, that language was not a language that was likely to have any purchase or traction in the villages of India or the smaller towns of India amongst people who are mostly illiterate or uneducated and really not clued into what the government is doing. And that the way in which they could be drawn into this idea of democratic planning is by interweaving into planning rhetoric ideas religious popular culture. And so to figures like Gulzar Lal Nanda, who was then the Minister of Industry and Planning, and a very devout Hindu himself, this was a way by which you could link the lok to the parlok, which is link this world to the next, that there was almost a spiritual dimension to planning that if it was suffused with this language of religion, specifically Hindu religion. And Nehru is, after a lot of cajoling by his minister, by Gulzar Lal Nanda, is somewhat convinced of it, though he remains very ambivalent. But what I trace through, so you have these quite, you know, amazing episodes in which you have Hindu holy men at something like the Kumbh Mela, which is the largest religious congregation in the world on the banks of the Ganga, the Ganges. You would find these Hindu holy men talking about the five-year plan, which is ostensibly secular, you know, and scientific, but talking about it in the language of the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, Hindu epics. And what you'd find, though, is that there were critics of this even within the Congress Party. There were certainly critics of this within civil society. Many people at the time were disappointed and suspicious of Nehru for engaging with this at the cost of state secularism. You would find that even the Hindu right wing Jan Sangh at the time was so sort of critical of the Congress's, what they thought of as the Congress's cynical use of these holy men, that they referred to these people as Congress sadhus, right? A sort of inversion of today's politics. But what I argue is that the Congress would find that this this compromise on secularism would ultimately blow up in its face, because after years of associating itself with Hindu causes, it would find that that played into the hands of Hindu nationalist politics, which was the trump card of its rivals, such as the Jan Sangh and eventually the BJP, and that the sadhus or the holy men in this sadhu samaj would prove very hard to control and drag the Congress Party into arenas where its secular commitments were always being threatened and its competitors were bound to succeed. So, for example, you see by 1966, there's the first attack on India's parliament. It's a violent attack. After a rally, after an anti-cow slaughter rally that is led by sadhus or Hindu holy men, many of whom are from the Bharat Sadhu Samaj. And the person who's forced to resign then is the Home Minister of India, who's in charge of law and order, is Gulzar Lal Nanda, right? It's sort of irony of his career that he sort of unleashes this in some ways on the Indian political sphere, and the chickens come home to roost, or the cows in this case. You also see that in 1964, with the founding of the ultra-right-wing organization, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the VHP, one of the founding vice presidents of it is a man named Sant Tukdoji Maharaj. And Sant Tukdoji Maharaj is, again, one of the founding members of the Bharat Sadhu Samaj, which was associated with the Congress Party. Whereas the VHP, as you know, most Indians know, is associated with the Hindu right-wing and the BJP today. You'd also find that in an echo of contemporary politics, that the Bharat Sadhu Samaj, which began as a venture by the Congress Party to promote the five-year plans, by the late 1980s and the 1990s, it is endorsing causes that are very much the centerpiece of the BJP's electoral campaign, which is that of bringing down the Babri Masjid in Ayodhya and building a temple instead.
So I want to now kind of maybe continue kind of moving forward to the present day. With maybe two related questions, how did these plans, eventually come to an end? I think India doesn't do these policy plans anymore. And where does that leave the state of in specifics Indian planning today?
Yes, planning comes to an end in India with the election of Narendra Modi as Prime Minister in 2014. During his Independence Day speech on August 15th, 2014, he makes it clear in his speech from the ramparts of the Red Fort, as all Indian prime ministers do. He makes it clear in his speech that the time has come to shutter the planning commission. And this was something that was widely expected by many political observers. It was seen as Narendra Modi's rejection of a Nehruvian past, his putting his stamp on the Indian economy, and turning to a new chapter in the Indian economy. In some ways, though historians don't believe in inevitability, it was always extremely probable that Modi would do away with planning, and this was for several reasons. One is that it is believed that Modi had a personal grouse against the Planning Commission, and that grouse was that, a personal or sort of professional grouse against the Planning Commission, which is that as a very popular chief minister of a state, Gujarat, from 2001 to 2014, like all chief ministers, he had to go, as the expression goes, hat in hand, to New Delhi, to Yojana Bhavan, to a technocrat who was the deputy chairman of the Planning Commission, and plead for outlays of funds for his state. Right, and that this is something that not just Modi, who is an enormously powerful and popular chief minister, but other chief ministers of other states also chafed at, that they did not think that unelected technocrats should be having this kind of power over the purse strings over over them. Apart from that, Modi's populist politics and his anti-intellectual and anti-technocratic instincts always suggested that a body that was associated with technocracy, like the Planning Commission, was going to be targeted, though he has replaced it with something which is very similar but rebranded, called the Niti Aayog. And we see some of his instincts towards anti-technocracy and anti-intellectualism with things such as huge and failed projects like demonetization in India. And lastly, as I said, there was a desire to eclipse a Nehruvian legacy, whether that was for the better or for the worse, and this was a way by which he could, as with many other things, he could signal that India was moving on from a Nehruvian past. Regarding the state of Indian statistics today, I'd say I'm not a statistician and I'm not an economist, but judging from the response and the reporting done by sort of business journalists, it appears that India's statistical infrastructure is in a very troubling state, and this is something that has been commented on widely. Last year, for example, The Economist carried a piece that described India's statistical system India's statistical system as once being a vaunted statistical system, but today as being crumbling. Over the last 5 years, we've discovered, as I said in the book, that good data isn't always good politics. And so we've seen national sample survey results suppressed. We've seen certain other studies discontinued. And when the findings of these discontinued studies or these suppressed studies have been leaked, it's become clear that it is when, or just coincidentally, just when the surveys showed record unemployment or declines in household spending. And the pity of it is that as a result, we don't have a firm baseline for assessing the levels of Indian poverty or unemployment. And so when the Indian government makes claims about these, about poverty reduction or unemployment reduction, it is not to say that it's always untrue, but it's just that we do not have a yardstick by which to judge it, whether it is true or not. And therefore, we have good reason to be suspicious of what any state puts out as claiming achievements without offering independent researchers access to the same data. And these criticisms have come from professional economists and statisticians ranging from the left to the right. It goes from Jean Dres and Arvind Subramaniam to Raghuram Rajan, Kaushik Basu, Abhijit Sen, Abhijit Banerjee, and international economists like Angus Deaton, Nestor Duflo, Thomas Piketty. And to sort of sum up, while Indian statistics have never entirely been immune from government interference, it does appear that more recently this has escalated. And this is quite to the detriment of all Indian citizens.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Nikhil Menon, author of Planning Democracy, Modern India's Quest for Development. Nikhil, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Thanks. People can find my work. This book, Planning Democracy, has been published by Cambridge University Press outside of South Asia and by Penguin in South Asia with slightly different subtitles, mostly the same book. Other work of mine, I've written for outlets like the BBC, the Indian Express, the Hindu Business Line, Scroll.in, the Caravan magazine. So those are some of the places that people can find my sort of non-academic writing. And I guess for academic writing, JSTOR would be the place to go. Coming to my next, to where my interests are moving, looking forward, I think that my next book is going to be a history of Indian cultural diplomacy and soft power projects from independence onwards. So what I'd like to do is to write a history of the ways in which India, though it emerges in 1947 as a overwhelmingly poor and militarily weak country, wants to punch above its weight in terms of international soft power and cultural diplomacy. And I want to look at the ways in which the Indian state tries to do so from independence and the 1950s until the present, and try to look at the different ways in which the ideologies of different governments are reflected in the kinds of soft power pushes made globally.
Well, you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The Asian Review of Books podcast is on all favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Join us next week for a conversation with Mai Nardone, author of Welcome Me to the Kingdom. But before then, Nikhil, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Nicholas.